Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome back, everyone. This is Sinclair DNA Radio. I'm Steve Sinclair, and today we're meeting with the author of a book on possibly the most maligned, most generous, most strategic member of the wider St. Clair family. The man is Major General, or rather was, Major General Arthur St. Clair. The book, Arthur St. Clair, The Invisible Patriot. The author, R.W. Dick Phillips. Welcome, Dick.
Thank you, Steve. I appreciate your letting me on your show here. That's cool. I really like it.
What? Yeah, you and I have been talking over the internet and through email and by phone calls for years now. And The book came out in 2014, I believe, so I'm a little bit behind getting you on here. I intended it for quite a while. It's a great book. And let's jump right in. Why did you write a book about St. Clair?
Well, he's got to be one of the most unappreciated military figures that ever was in history. He had 40 years service to America in military and public service, and people have dissed him, shut down his good points, highlighted anything they thought was his bad points. And I started getting into this. I kind of backed into it, and I didn't know. I had relocated in retirement to this little community. Well, it's not a little community. It's a city called St. Clairsville, Ohio. And everybody, I was in Rotary, and everybody was telling me, you know, I had been writing articles about the Revolution and stuff, and they said, well, have you ever looked at our namesake? And I said, well, no, not really. And, well, why don't you look at them, you know? And so I started looking and started asking people, and even in the city, nobody was really sure what all he did. And so the more I dug, the more I realized I was just blown away. I mean, layer after layer after layer. It was like peeling an onion, you know. I've always been a champion, the underdog. I used to be in the PR business for 30 years. And you're always representing clients to get a big kick out of it. And here was a guy, and here I am in retirement, and here's a guy. This is going to be my retirement project. And that was like over 6 years ago. That's when I first talked to you about it, and you gave me some encouragement, and because nothing had been done on this man. And so that's kind of what got me started. I kind of got ticked off that our country could treat a guy like this so badly, and nobody knows him, and we weren't educated about him or anything in schools because everybody sidestepped him, you know. And so anyway, that's what got me started.
Well, a lot of people outside of the St. Clair family, and even some inside, are surprised that he was an American president. Tell me that story.
Well, actually, everybody gets confused. See, our historians, that wrote all our textbooks and things, they kind of started with Washington, which is the first president, obviously elected with the full authority of the Constitution, the separation of the executive office from Congress and that. Well, they forget is at the beginning of the Revolutionary War and all through the Revolutionary War, somebody had to be our chief executive officer. When we had to do things with other countries, who was going to do it? So Congress elected a president of Congress, and the guy's actual title was President of the United States in Congress Assembled, and they were authorized by the Articles of Confederation that were loosely put together before the Revolutionary War. There were 14. I mean, it took a brave man to stand up during the Revolutionary War and be President of the United States, and these guys stood tall. Arthur St. Clair was one of them. There were 14 of them, and he was about the second last before Washington. And there were 14 in all. In fact, John Hancock he served twice. He served once, and then he came back again because they couldn't find anybody to do it. But he was a very brave guy in the Revolution, and you know, the biggest signer of the Declaration of Independence. And boy, I wish I had that guy's kind of courage. You know, it just blows you away what some of these people did back in that time. So actually, Arthur St. Clair was president of Congress in 1787. Now, that's a very important year in American history because that is the year that the Constitutional Convention was convened and Washington was brought back from retirement to chair it. And they hammered out the Constitution of the United States. And some people say it couldn't have been done if it wasn't for Washington's strength because he kept everybody online. Everybody's a little intimidated by Washington by this time. Anyway, so that's what happened. And then also, during that same year, Arthur St. Clair helped draft the Northwest Ordinance, which was the document that backed up America's expansion west of the Ohio. And it initially was written to, you know, nobody thought beyond the Mississippi at that time, but it actually is still in effect today. The Northwest Ordinance, Alaska and Hawaii followed those guidelines. And he was involved in that during his presidency. So but nobody ever talks about those presidents, and very few people know about them. And actually, I was put onto it by a fellow that that had done a study on this, and he was, because I started at the Library of Congress too, getting all my leads and doing all that before I started following up all these things for 6 years. And he was, you know, this man was a very astute historian. He goes all around the country, and has for many years. And he did a study on this, and he wrote a book called The Forgotten Founders. I'm looking for his name here. I made a note of his name because I always forget it. But anyway, I can't see it right now, but I'll bring it back later. But he was the one that just a whole book on this, and he did a bio like on each one of them and all that. And he says he found all this stuff in the Library of Congress, and nobody ever wanted to admit that it existed because they started with Washington in 1789. I just, these things get done, and people do things for their own reasons, and it's just weird, you know. And if you don't dig, you know, you just don't find anything. And the history that I, excuse the expression, didn't learn in school is because the people who did write the textbooks for people that would learn in school, it was kind of a homogenized view, and they picked their heroes, and they, you know, we all know when you have a mission and you don't want to deviate because it slows down the process of whatever. You can't keep doing sidebars. And so they went with the Washingtons and Washington and Adams and Jefferson and, you know, on and on and on. And but like they didn't have time for this guy. And yet he was there is evidence to suggest in the last 7 years I've found enough evidence to convince me that Arthur St. Clair is actually the guy who planned the strategies that basically saved Washington's bacon, because back in 1776 in December, he was the only guy that provided troops and came in and led a brigade. And I have all kinds of certification that most of the generals that were on Washington's staff said, you know, Washington was a great man, did a lot of things, was a great manager and a great leader of men, but he was not a good military strategist in his early years. St. Clair had all that experience, and he brought it to the thing. I mean, those night maneuvers,
in Trenton, right? Yeah, that was a great part of your book is how you outlined the confusion at what they would do in the face of so many British troops who were basically saying, "Hey, we see you out there. We don't care. We're going to destroy you in the morning."
Yeah,
and
they were very.
St. Clair's idea to flank them.
They were
right?
very nonplussed about the whole thing. Well, British kind of fought that way anyway when they weren't, you know. I mean, they kind of, you know, they have their tea in the afternoon when they should be fighting, you know, and stuff like that, and they bivouac for the winter. And this is something that apparently Washington didn't understand, because he had retreated from 9 battles in a row during 1776. Just to preserve the existence of the army, because with the Declaration of Independence, if you don't have an army to back it up, it's non-existent. You know, it's a nice piece of paper, but you got to stand behind it. Well, he took his several hundred troops over to Newton. He was kind of holed up, hoping the British wouldn't cross the Delaware to take him out finally, and that's when St. Clair showed up. But he had been ordered to, but Washington had ordered several generals to provide him troops, and St. Clair was the only one who actually recruited an army, trained it, and brought it down, about 2,000 troops. And when he showed up, Washington is said to have said, "You're the first person in my new command that's ever followed an order that I gave on a large scale." Because the other generals, like Horatio Gates and Charles Lee, I mean, they were senior generals, had a lot of experience. They were kind of miffed that they didn't get Washington's job. So as a result, they weren't going to help him do anything. So right. When they requested stuff, when he requested troops and help from them, they held back. You know, it's like first, second, and third time. And they finally, Charles Lee's quoted as saying is, "Well, I'm not going to help because if he fails, I'll get his job." Well, he
right.
Somehow missed the fact that the war would be over if Washington
failed. Yeah, and all of them could likely have hung
yeah,
for their crime.
Yeah, a lot of egos in these hierarchies that had a lot to do with the things that didn't happen to St. Clair. And it's like you say, it's a story today the same. Egos are all involved, you know, and
mm-hmm.
everybody wants credit and all that kind of stuff. And it's a shame to see because, you know, you can see it more clearly as you get older. And it's mm-hmm. I think it's a little more frustrating, you know. But anyway.
You know, Dick, when they were making that retreat, and basically it was a series of retreats Washington was making up out of Brooklyn across into Manhattan, and they got run up the island of Manhattan and headed west across the Hudson, how they got over mm-hmm. there. I mean, it's so deep there and dangerous. But there was no bridge. There was a ferry and, I believe, boats. But they got over to Fort Lee, and then they made their way south where there was a headquarters set up in Morristown where Washington was.
Right.
But
right.
And I'll digress just a minute for this part of the story.
Go ahead.
And that is I ride bikes a lot. I ride at 10 speed with a club, and our Saturday morning ride, we finish up by coming down this huge hill. First we go up a huge hill, and we do that on a road called Tempe Wick. And we go down the other side, really flying down through there, and it never occurred to me to think, why is that road called Tempe Wick? And it's through an area called Jockey Hollow that any Revolutionary War buffs listening in will know very well.
Yeah, I've heard that.
That's the place. Yeah, and I wanted to take my kids up there to see it. They were about 10, 11, something like that. So my wife and I took the kids up, and we're heading up to see the reconstructed huts that like 12 men or so slept in, tiny little huts. And we go past this house called the Wick House. It turns out mm-hmm. that's where a young lady named Tempe Wick lived. That's why the road is called Tempe Wick. But during the Revolutionary encampment there, Washington's troops stayed right on their land, and certain powerful people in the Revolutionary Army took over the house. They didn't kick the people out. They agreed they would only take like half of it. Mm-hmm. And the Wick House served as the headquarters for a certain General Arthur St. Clair.
Mm-hmm.
So we're standing there. We're standing there listening to this, and there's a woman in there giving the talk about the place. She's in period costume, and she said that sentence, that it was the headquarters of General Arthur St. Clair. And my kids turn to me and go, "Wow, we're famous." I'm like, not so fast. Not so fast. My line does not descend from that branch in the DNA study. We're not going to go off on a DNA discussion, but the family does have 12 distinct lineages. And him being where he's from, up in Caithness, it makes total sense that he would match our Caithness group. And I think that's
sure.
already been pretty well solved. But it's nice to have that name show up and to be this close to us. And then they made their way south to Trenton, where he had his moment in the spotlight.
I'm delighted to hear that story because so many people would never mention his name. I mean, I have run it. You wouldn't believe the amount of times of things that he did where he, if he did something good, like saving Washington and helping him out and all the, you know, he didn't get any credit, but any smell of anything or any different agenda, he either got lambasted or he got no credit for the things that he did. It's really an interesting story. But, anyway, I digress too. But that's a fascinating story. I never actually quite knew that story at all. I had heard the word.
It's all around us, actually. The history of this is all around us here in northern New Jersey. So, Dick, if you would, give the listeners an overall perspective. What does the book include? What's in it?
Let's see. I already said part of it. I'd say probably the it really spans his entire 84 years. I mean, in that day and age when people lived to be 50 if they were lucky, this guy lived 84 years, and it spans his whole career before, during, and after the revolution, and how he played a role in all those things after he came over from Great Britain, started out fighting the Canadian, the French Indian War in Canada, and he fought that for 5 years, and then he came down, settled in western Pennsylvania. In retirement, and they got married and come down. They start having their family, and he's getting adjusted and finding out all kinds of opportunities and beginning to work with Governor Penn and stuff. I won't go into this whole thing, but basically what happens is for the first 10 years before the Revolutionary War, he's actually fighting for the Scots and Scotch-Irish settlers in western Pennsylvania when he realizes that they're being raided by the Indians all the time. He uses his previous skills, and then he finds out that the British have incited these riots. He didn't find that out at first. He was just fighting Indians. So he set up things, and he set up rangers, and they were all volunteers, and then suddenly Governor Penn heard about him and started supporting him with funds and weapons and stuff like that. And so he did that, plus then by that time he had earned favor with Governor John Penn, and he started promoting him to judgeships and things like that. So he fought the British in Pennsylvania for a long time before he ever got in the Revolutionary War. So, by the time he got to, join the Continental Army, I mean, he was really experienced. I mean, he'd done a lot of things. So it's not hard to say that Washington wasn't, maybe experienced in certain areas, and St. Clair could really help him out. But nobody... You read Washington's biographers. There's over 1,000 people that have written books about Washington. There are two about St. Clair. One was in 1882. One was in 1937. And this is only the third book ever written about Arthur St. Clair. And I thought, oh my God, how he was Washington, almost like Washington's sidekick for 20 years, but obviously Washington got all the credit. And the one thing about that New Jersey deal with the trilogy of victories in New Jersey that St. Clair helped him out, one of the things I like to mention is Congress was ready to fire Washington before those three victories, because everybody was down on him, and he had lost most of his troops and all that. When St. Clair came in and helped him out, everybody on the inside, the other generals and the Congress, but nobody outside, knew, obviously, that St. Clair played such a big role in this turnaround of the war. And Congress was not too fond of St. Clair because they knew what he did, and he kind of spoiled their plans because they were ready to fire Washington. And that's kind of how his... it's real hard to pin this down exactly, but, when you look at these things and connect the dots, that's what I don't think has been done all that well in the past, is the connecting of the dots and the cause and effect kind of things and who was doing what to who at the time. That's what makes the book, I think, interesting. And what I've got in there is about five of the untold stories about St. Clair that I found very fascinating, that either they were put out intentionally wrong when Congress reported what happened, or they had another agenda or whatever. And on two occasions, they actually made St. Clair the scapegoat, jumping forward on from Trenton. And several months later, I don't know where Washington was at the time, but Congress took John Hancock, who was in his second term, and instructed him to write a letter ordering St. Clair to Fort Ticonderoga. But they didn't do anything to prepare for Fort Ticonderoga. I don't know how they realized that if you drive them out of New Jersey, they're not going to marshal another 11,000 force at the top of New York and come down, And so they didn't do it. And they didn't repair the fort that he was supposed to. It was built by the French 20-some years ago. So they just sent him in there with nothing. They sent him 1,000 extra troops. So here he was, 2,000 troops, in an old fort falling apart that was built for 10,000 troops. connected with all the firing positions and what have. And he's also got a thousand people that are infirmed, you know, that are not able to fight. And so the 11,000 British, he's surrounded by 6,000 on land, and the British did something that nobody else had ever done before. They black and tackled their cannon up to the top of Mount Defiance, which overlooked Fort Ticonderoga. And as the days dwindled down to when the battle was really going to begin, Arthur St. Clair realized that they can annihilate us in no time with these cannon, plus we don't have the men. So he made this really probably one of the most fateful decisions of his life, and courageous at that, to take his troops out at night. We should call him the Night Warrior, because a lot of things he did were done at night, you know. And if I ever rewrite a second edition, maybe I'd call it the Night Warrior. But no, it's just, he got it. He says, I'm going to get you guys out to the woods where you can fight these British, at least have a chance. And so they fight fought
guerrilla
for weeks
war.
In there. Yeah, guerrilla.
Guerrilla tactics, right.
Yeah, right. And they were dropping trees and doing all kinds of stuff, you know, slowing down the British. The British's ultimate goal at this time was to take Albany. And St. Clair did two things with his retreat. He slowed them down. He was able to take a lot of them out. He saved about half of his own men that were all going to be gone. He knew it was annihilation time. And they lived to survive and fight the British again when Burgoyne finally surrendered at Saratoga. And that's a whole other story. But the point is, because that's not the way Congress had told everybody it was going to happen, they kept saying Fort Ticonderoga is impregnable, we don't have to worry. Well, they didn't do anything to prepare. And as a result, they had told everybody that's the way it was going to happen. Well, when St. Clair realized he had to make another decision, all of a sudden, when they found out that he had left the fort, and, you know, they started calling him a coward and, you know, leaving his post, and they even court-martialed him. I mean, they said they were going to court-martial him. However, they put out the fact to the world that St. Clair was a coward and he left his post and they're going to court-martial him and all this and that. And you know who the two leaders of this were? John Adams and Samuel Adams, the two cousins that were leaders of Congress. And, you know, these are stories you never hear because, you know, everybody talks about, you know, everybody's all polished up and, you know, never did anything wrong, you know, really.
Right.
But this is, so Washington, wherever he was, he came in, he found out what they did and what was happening to St. Clair, and he went in and rescued them, and he took them back to his staff, and the court-martial and all that, all the 2 years of bad PR was done, Clair, and when the next Congress came in, they looked at his case, which had never been tried, and they turned around and not only exonerated him, they commended him for his courage, but it was too late. I mean, nobody announced then, who cares by that time? You know,
right.
He'd already been, you know, been the scapegoat for something that really didn't happen. He did something good. He got made to look like a scapegoat, like he deserted his post. So I got to slow down here because I get carried away and then you don't ask any questions. So, I mean, if I'm talking, it's hard for you to ask me questions. But that's
no,
that's kind of what it's all about.
Yeah, no, people are listening in for the answers, not the questions.
Yeah.
So it's interesting to me, a lot of the names you're mentioning had nothing to do with military service and the people making those judgments on his tactical decision to get out of Ticonderoga and save his men to fight for another day weren't military strategists, you know?
No, well, they weren't even military men. I mean,
they
Monday morning quarterbacks. I call them micromanagers of the war.
Yeah.
I mean, they were the ones that sent us up to Canada to attack Canada after the Boston siege of Boston, which was the first victory. And, you know, we got annihilated up there because they had no intelligence and they'd had nothing.
Right.
And plus, all those people were against us. We had won their favor by helping them chase the French out of Canada, and then by attacking Canada, you know, who knows how many
wrong
streets they sent us down, you know, and you know, Actually, there's another story about St. Clair's. That's how he became a brigadier general. When he raised another army before the one for Washington. He actually raised four armies for Washington during a 20-year span. The first one was he raised about 900 in Pennsylvania and took them up to, in French, it's Three Rivers, like the Three Rivers in Pittsburgh, but it's Trois Rivières. I forgot how to pronounce it. But anyway, he went up there and found General John Sullivan's army completely blocked and ready to be annihilated, and he figured out his strategy of how to break them free, and they became good friends after that. But also, he was a colonel when he first joined, and that got him brigadier general. And then he went to brigadier general, and then he came and met Washington for the first time and did all the stuff in Trenton. Well, I mean, this guy's a lion, you know, in the American Revolution, and the powers that be, and you know, with their own agendas and what have you, they didn't give him anything. And as a result, even when I once had a guy when I was at Library of Congress when I first went, I was lamenting, you know, there are three buildings there, and it's in February and it's colder than hell, and I'm running around in the tunnels back and forth between the buildings, and I go to the cafeteria and grab a bite, and I'm sitting there and I'm kind of grousing a little bit about it. I says, geez, I'm all worn out from running around these buildings. Every time I get a lead someplace, it leads me to another building, you know, and then back and forth. The guy said to me, he said, well, Dick, I'll tell you this. He says, if this Library of Congress were limited to the people who said something new, you'd only have one building, you know, to worry about. And I thought, he says, you know how many people write books just to get their ISBN number and put something on the shelf so they can look at it, you know, and it's nothing new, it's just a rehash of everybody else's stuff. And there's probably a certain amount of truth to that, and I'm sure the guy was kidding me, but still in all, it does create a thing there where, you know, I went and looked. I reached a point about halfway through this. You know, I had several years in this thing, you know, and I'm compiling all this stuff and deducing all this stuff. You know, a lot of it is opinion and theory. It's not all pure factual history. I guess that's what used to be, to me, pretty boring in my early years. But when you see how these things happened and why and what the timing was and who the people were, you get, gee whiz, this is, you know, this homogenized version of history that we've been reading all our life. So you go around and you dig in the nooks and crannies and you kind of start coming up with common denominators. But even then, and I think here's one of the cruxes of my credibility on this book, is, you know, you reach the point where you say to yourself, hey, I don't have a PhD in history. I've been in the PR business 30 years and I'm studying the Revolutionary War for six. What the hell do I know? That's what people are going to say. You know, you mm-hmm. question yourself. Everybody does. But I had this thing that hit me. And I said, you know, what did I learn in PR? It's not the direct approach always. It's the third-party approach. So if I could get a third party to back me up, so I immediately changed my research or adjusted it, and I started researching all of the bios about Washington's generals, especially the ones that fought with St. Clair and Washington. And I started reading these bios, like General Greene and General Sullivan, and all of them attested to his major role in the trilogy of victories in New Jersey, and, you know, they all acknowledged him. You look at Washington's biographers, they're so busy preserving Washington's reputation that anything that, like St. Clair doing that, you know, they ignore. They don't put it in there. Or they don't even want to admit that Washington was ever in dire straits. And, you know, I talk like this, and it makes me, I must appear like I'm trying to denigrate Washington. I'm not. He was a fantastic. He's everything everybody says he was. But he was not perfect, you know. And there was things he couldn't do which he got credit for. And, you know, the top guy always gets credit. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that after 240 years, maybe somebody ought to acknowledge that St. Clair did some great things and deserved to be recognized for them. You know, you don't have one statue or one anything in D.C. anywhere about St. Clair. And that's because people were down on him. You know what it takes to get a monument. There has to be a whole bevy of people that raise the money and get the things and
mm-hmm.
say, well, we want to do this, you know, and then Congress approves it or whoever has to approve it, but or the city or whatever. But no, there was apparently nobody willing to do that for St. Clair because they didn't feel he measured up because there was, you know, all they'd heard about was, all they heard about was bad news, so they kind of hunkered down and didn't say anything. But when I started getting all this so-called evidence, third party, about people he served with who said what he did and different things, they didn't come out and say what saved Washington completely, but they did acknowledge that he came in and, you know, he brought troops, he led a brigade, he did the strategic planning. And they kind of inferred that without him, you know, who knows whether we would have won that or not, you know. And so, I mean, the guy was a difference maker. He really did. And he was as near as I can figure out, he was kind of an honored duty country guy. Yes, sir, three bags full. He didn't have an agenda like all these other generals, you know, I don't want to say all the other ones, but they all did, and the politicians as well. But he was kind of, you know, as great as he was a little bit of a novice when it comes to human relations and making sure he didn't get taken advantage of, you know.
And here you are, a PR guy.
yeah. And I'm seeing all this, and it's frustrating the heck out of me, you know. I'm saying,
yeah.
Oh, my God, you know. I used to go, when I go around speaking around the three states, this is about all I can get to. I give lectures and do book signings and stuff. And, you know, I usually tell the people, I says, you know, I'm retired from public relations, and this is my pro bono client because I just had to take them on. And it turned out to be a really good retirement project, and I'm glad I did it. And it's really fun now talking about the book with people and, you know, doing lectures and, you always learn something every time you go out. You know, there's always somebody who knows something you didn't know, and it's always fun. And hopefully I'm building up some fans for poor old Arthur St. Clair.
I want to read one little bit out of the preface. St. Clair walked with the giants of the American Revolution, Washington,
yeah.
Franklin, Adams,
yeah.
Jefferson, Greene, Lafayette, and others. And yet for more than two centuries, history has been reluctant to mention that St. Clair. Talk to me about the problems with Congress, because they ran deep, didn't they? Even down to financial issues.
Well, he mostly had. There's a certain irony here. When he was in the field, being a general, being military, he seemed to have all kinds of problems with Congress because they were micromanaging the war. And if he didn't do dress right, and do it exactly as they told you, even if you killed all your men, then they gave him a hard time. And the irony in it is, after the Revolutionary War, when he, retired, as they all did, retired and back to their homelands, and he went back to Pennsylvania to try to build up all the fortunes. Because he had also advanced a lot of money, he and his wife, to Washington, who was always in dire straits and didn't have any money and men leaving and all that stuff. But when he got back, he was starting to get his jobs back, his judicial jobs and things like that. Well, it wasn't 2 years, and suddenly he got persuaded to run for Congress, and he gets elected in 1785, and he serves in Congress in 1785 and 1786, and then they elect him their president in 1787. Well, the contrast that he should always be at odds with Congress when he's out in the field, and when he's there, right there with them, everything is hunky-dory, you know, is kind of funny. And I don't want to take it any further than that because I really don't know. It just seems strange to me, you know, but when he was the farther away he was from Congress, the more problems he seemed to have. And that doesn't bode very well to take that further, because I don't want to, you know, impugn everybody else, but it is kind of strange, you know. Up front and personal, no problem, but in the back, because he didn't exactly do what they wanted all the time. He'd always go for the result. He'd get the result. But he didn't do them their way, and, you know, the way they micromanage the war, and then they tell everything what they're going to do, you know, and tell the people, oh, we're going to do this and that and the other thing, and then it didn't happen exactly the way they said it. So they would take umbrage from that, and they would, you know, they would try to lay them out. The biggest single problem, and probably most the outside of the five untold stories, one of those five untold stories that I tell in here is the one he's been lambasted for most is the so-called it's the massacre at the Wabash in 1791.
Mm-hmm.
He is totally unequivocally faulted for that all by himself. And most people who don't know anything about him, if they know anything, just a little bit, it's that. And that he was the guy that got 600 and some guys killed, massacred by the Indians. But what they don't tell is the real story. And it's chapter 17 in my book. And I go way back to when all this Indian potential problem started back in 1774 when he told congressional commissioners that, because he knew the British, and he was just inciting the Indians and all that. He knew how they worked. And he said, they're in Fort Detroit. I want to take a group of 500 volunteers, and I want to go up there and take them out of there, because whatever happens in the future, you can bet they're going to be inciting Indian attacks. That was 1774. You fast forward to 1791, after the revolution's over, Congress let the British keep Fort Detroit when they should have taken it away from them and got them the heck out of it, because what they did is spend the next 8 years building up an Indian army, a confederation of Indian troops. Congress never took the Indians seriously. And after the Revolutionary War was over, they made this huge error in allowing them to stay there instead of taking them out, because the war was really not over, because they were fighting it from there through the Indians and not admitting that they were. And all of a sudden, here's St. Clair, who gets appointed the first federal governor of the Northwest Territory with responsibility of everything, of developing everything between Ohio River and the Mississippi River, and which are now five states. And he's sitting there saying, oh, my God, you know, they won't sign treaties. They're giving us all kinds of stuff. And so all of a sudden the settlers, who were former veterans of the Revolution, they're trying to settle there with their families. So they're going to Congress and they're saying, well, we're not going to fight them all the time. You take them yourself, you know. Oh, and well, Congress don't have any soldiers to speak of because they have never prepared at all. So General Harmar, which never really gets talked about much because he had the first massacre of about half the troops, they never talk about him, but they talk about St. Clair the year after. He wasted basically the only army. There was only like 1,200 regular troops left because they didn't think they need them. They had one, you know, they had one army. And he went up there, and there was hardly anything left of those people. And Congress, instead of saying, uh-oh, this didn't work out well, we should plan, we better not do anything too quickly because we don't have any troops, and number two, we should take time to build an army, train an army, and go back the next spring and not do it in the winter. No, that ain't the way they did it. They ordered President Washington to put together an army and find a general, and they're going back after him. Well, there was no army. Well, how did this happen? This is really weird, because it was given to Washington to do it, and his Secretary of War, Henry Knox. And there's a guy, you know, we all know about Fort Knox and all kinds of stuff, and everybody thinks he's wonderful. None of the bad stuff ever came out about him. The guy was an entrepreneur investor, and he lost his butt about this time on land up in Maine. And Washington was a land investor, too, but he didn't lose. He seemed to do okay. But so Washington, in really what was a bad decision, maybe his heart was in the right place, but his mind wasn't, apparently, because he pulls General St. Clair, who's now Governor St. Clair and has been retired Major General for 8 years, and is only 2 years younger than him. And I'm sure he didn't want to go lead a war, but he picks General St. Clair because he remembers that way back when they were buds fighting together, that he was a great general. Well, all of a sudden, all this is dumped on Arthur St. Clair. You can imagine how he must have felt, having already talked about taking it out and handling the problem, you know, almost 20 years ago, that now he's faced with the problem, and they're telling him to go solve it when he has nothing to work with. Well, he raised an army, you know, from the prisons and everywhere else. They didn't have time to train him because they wanted him to leave right away. But that ain't the worst thing that happened. In my estimation, the worst thing that happened was Henry Knox lost real heavily on his land investments, which should have nothing to do with this. However, he extorted the money that was budgeted for St. Clair's campaign. And as a result, he instructed his quartermaster to buy all the cheapest in every way, shape, or form, including powder that was not, the musket balls were bouncing off the Indians and all kinds of stuff. And uniforms falling off, you know, shoes falling off, tools that didn't work. He bought the absolute cheapest of everything he could, got castle, all kinds of livestock from central Pennsylvania when all he had to do was go across the river to Kentucky, and then hauled them down the Ohio and around, and they were emaciated by the time they got there. Then none of this stuff got to St. Clair until he was already well on the way. Had he seen all this before he left, he never would have went because he wasn't prepared. He had things that didn't work. Well, that's what happened, and of course, this is a weird thing. There were all kinds of people who were at fault on this thing, and St. Clair, Congress realized, because Congress was at fault too. How do you hold Congress accountable other than a long-term thing of voting and all that baloney? But even then, people say, do you really hold them accountable?
Right.
Here again, they were at fault. So was Henry Knox. So was Washington. But who's the only guy that ever gets tagged for that loss? I mean, it was a loss, and he was the major general. But he was not equipped. He had lost the war before he ever left for Washington in Cincinnati. And yet he's the only one that is faulted, even though a congressional investigation, the first ever that we ever had, found that all these people were culpable. Now, they're not going to say Washington and they're not going to say Congress, but Knox and his quartermaster and all those other people, they found them culpable, but they never punished them. They never announced them or anything. So I think probably the worst thing that ever happened to St. Clair is he and his family, and I got this from a lot of people calling around the country when I was writing this book, you know, they're almost embarrassed because he's carrying a stigma of being the scapegoat for this war. When there was plenty that he should have shared it with, or that should have been shared with. But the point is that you know how that thing goes. It goes on and on and on and on, and it builds. And I had an editor. I was writing a story about Arthur St. Clair a few years back, and the last portion of it was about this war. I didn't know as much about it as I knew then, as I knew now, but. The editor felt they knew all about it, you know, and so they you know, their visuals all around the page and that bloody this and bloody that and da-da-da-da-da. So the whole story became, image-wise, a story of the bloody massacre, and the editor rewrote it, the last portion of it, and I had to object and all that and finally get it back to where I could live with the copy and have take all the stuff off. And you know, but that's where people are limited by their knowledge. You know, we both know, we've spent our lives in this business, that people are limited by what they don't know. And if they don't know it, it didn't exist. I have problems with newspaper editors today because they think they know all there is to know because they learned it in school. And I know that not to be true, but, you know, try to get them convinced. My probably biggest, longest client when I was in the business was the University of Phoenix for 12 years. I took them on, and they were considered, you know, anathema by the whole journalistic community, and they had all been educated in higher education. That's the only way to do it. Well, along comes this guy named John Sperling, and he's out of Berkeley, and he's a liberal, and he anything's possible kind of a guy, and he realizes there's a whole market of people who are now successful in business who didn't get their degrees. So he forms a university, which, as you may know, is now the largest university in the world.
Yeah.
But back there in 88, I had to build credibility for them, and you did it state by state as they got their license. And the battles over and over again to get editors to at least accept the fact that it wasn't just the McDonald's of education and that there was really a focus on it. And eventually we turned it around. I mean, I don't have 12 years, you know, but eventually people began to realize it for what it was, that it was oranges and apples. Well, this is a lot like that. Arthur St. Clair is a lot like that. They all think, if they know him at all, they think he's a putz. And it really gripes me, because his story needs to be told as it was and as he really contributed 40 years military and public service, my goodness, you know, and no credit at all. And I that's just the way I feel, you know, after having been through all this. He's like a friend at this point who I want to help. But that's kind of where it is. I don't know where we are in time. Are you watching it?
Oh, yeah. I've got a couple points I want to make real quick. First, okay. Anyone who wants to call in and chat with Dick Phillips about Arthur St. Clair, the Invisible Patriot, the number is 646-668-8487. Again, 646-668-8487. Dick, I want to read a couple of things from the book. In your chapter 21 is a timeline, 40 years of American patriotism at a glance.
Mm-hmm.
In 1783, while in Philadelphia, he responded to Congress as being held hostage by Continental Army veterans by resolving a back pay dispute.
Mm-hmm.
Later in 1803, so almost 20 years later, the second to the last thing in the timeline, besieged with personal creditors and the government creditors for the promissory notes he had written on the government's behalf, St. Clair and his family lost all their property and possessions in Pennsylvania. The community of Ligonier today rests on the thousands of acres the St. Clairs once owned, but were never able to enjoy in retirement. I want to read one more thing, and that is the quote you have that starts chapter 4. It's a quote by Major General Arthur St. Clair.
Mm-hmm.
I hold that no man has the right to withhold his services when his country needs them. Be the sacrifice ever so great, it must be yielded on the altar of patriotism. That gives me chills in light of how much he gave and how he died in poverty.
That is very true, and it's so obvious I forgot it. But I didn't forget this one. I got this quote set up because here's another thing you don't know about, or most people don't know about Arthur St. Clair. In the 14 years he was governor of the Northwest Territory, one of his chief adversaries was Thomas Jefferson, who was then president, who became president in 1801. But Jefferson, to get elected and to beat Adams out of his second term, had to form his own party. Well, he picked up the term anti-federalist, and they really weren't anti-federalists. They were the guys that hung out for the Bill of Rights and said, yeah, I'll sign it, but get a Bill of Rights in there on the Constitution. But that didn't make them, you know, non-federalists or non-anybody. They were just holding out for what they thought was right. Well, Jefferson, he thought that, boy, he didn't like some of those guys anyway. He and Hamilton were always at it. And So he coins his party name, Anti-Federalist, and he builds it up during Adams's whole. He's supposed to be his vice president, and he's building up his dissenter party, who all, lion's share of them, are all pro-slavers. So when St. Clair took over, obviously the first state he had of the five, of the six that he had a bill and laid down judicial items for and all that, was Ohio. Well, he battled Ohio for 14 years because that was the first one, and all the anti-federalists who became the Republican Democrats, who eventually the spirit of which became the Republican Party, were all pro-slavers, and or most of them were anyway. And St. Clair was so afraid because there was a deadlock. There was eight free states and eight slave states before Ohio, and the next one was going to break the tie either way. Well, one of St. Clair's biggest self-appointed jobs was to make sure that Ohio became a free state. And it finally did, but he got fired before it happened, but he had laid all the groundwork for 14 years. But actually, Jefferson fired him for that reason, because he gave this speech to the Ohio legislature before, in the year before he left. He says, quote, "Let them say what they will about republicanism. A man who is willing to entail slavery upon any part of God's creation is no friend to the national happiness of any. And had he the power, would as readily enslave his neighbors as the poor black that has been torn from his country and his friends." General Arthur St. Clair, address to the Ohio State Legislature, 1802. And he was fired right after that because Jefferson respected him as a military man and different things that he had done, but he was still an adversary, you know, and so he finally succumbed to the pressure of his party, and he fired him on the spot. Besides, they needed a Democratic Republican governor, because St. Clair, the one thing he had that kept him in the Northwest Territory and in Ohio was he, Congress, the one thing they gave him, they didn't give him any money, they didn't give him any support, but what they did give him was veto power. And everybody in Ohio hated him for that. You know, there's still people today, every time I go speak, they say, and then I have to tell them, I said, do you really know the story about him, you know, and this and that, and then we finally settle him down a little bit. But that's been passed down through generations. You know, we're all a product of what our ancestors tell us, you know, unless we go out and do it ourselves. But the neat thing about that is not only did Ohio become a free state, but the next five states in the territory all became free states. And it wasn't until after Jefferson made the Louisiana Purchase, which started at the Mississippi and went west, that Louisiana became the first or the next slave state under Jefferson's command. And it just, you know, you look at these things, history never gets told this way, but these are the kind of things that just, you know, they kind of blow you away. You just never realized, you know, and they like all connect together. The dots are connected, and it's a fantastic story. And there's so much more detail, but that's kind of the high points, I guess, mostly pretty well.
The times we live in now, if you look at it and you're living in it and you read the news and watch what's going on, it's incredibly complex. There's so much nuance happening. Yet when they write about it 10, 15, 20 years from now, and then when they write about it again 20, 40 years, 80 years after that, they'll zero in on the textbook sort of accepted approach rather than the
I
much
call
more
it homogenized.
Complex. Yeah, I like that. And that's what I find in our DNA research is DNA matches are real matches, and you see people circling around one another, families with different names circling around one another, because of that kind of complexity. Because people didn't live in a vacuum, and they didn't live in a neat little pigeonhole. There was a lot of friction and a lot going on between all these different people that just gets missed. And I think your book does a lot to clarify that about General Arthur St. Clair.
Well, thank you for that.
So
Let
me ask you this, Dick. What else? Final question. What else do you wish more people knew about St. Clair?
Oh, I just think they that we don't have the right story about them. I just wish that more people. I have an answer to that. I thought I did. I was thinking about it. Let's see. Well, I guess that was the one thing that nobody knows for sure is the story I just told you about Ohio and slavery and stuff like that. Nobody knows about mm-hmm. that. But I just wish that people, that they knew that the stuff, the negative stuff that has been put out about him over the last 240 years has really not been reported correctly. And it's taken as gospel by generation after generation. And this guy was a great man. I mean, I can't even fathom all he contributed to this world, let alone country, you know. And it, he just is, he was about as, he comes off real straight arrow to me. I haven't found anything to nullify that. He just seems like he's one of these guys that, you know, that old line about, you fall down and it's not how quick you fall down, it's how fast you get up. I mean, he did throughout his career over. He was just relentless. And I can't help but admire that, you know. I mean, some people say they didn't like him because they thought he was haughty and educated and crap. But, you know, he didn't seem like he was really that kind of guy. That's just the way he was raised. He was raised as an aristocrat in Scottsdale. That's where he used to live. Scotland. And his mother raised him that way because his father died early. But she knew that he had aristocratic royalty blood in him, and she raised him with all the, you know, ability to handle yourself in a social situation. He would have never probably married the gal that he did because she was the niece of the Massachusetts governor if he couldn't ingratiate himself in those things. All his skills that his mother taught him and he learned at the university. He went to the University of Edinburgh to study medicine. Oh, I forgot one thing. I was real pleased. Two things. We talked about, you mentioned Fort Ligonier in Pennsylvania. And the land that he owned and all that. And now the fort that's there is a museum now. And several weeks ago I was there to speak, and we had a really nice turnout. And they know a lot about him there, so that was kind of really fun. The other thing is the Roslyn Chapel in Scotland. They are now carrying this book in their visitor center. And one of the reasons, other than they think it's a good yarn, is the fact that Arthur St. Clair's ancestors built Roslyn Castle in 1457. They also built Roslyn Chapel, and they also built Roslyn Castle, which is no more. It's been knocked down. And also
well, there's still some up there, actually. You can still go see it.
Really?
There's still
some
there. Oh, yeah. Been there.
But they
very
built
nice.
That. So here's a guy, you know, I use the line as underlying tagline as, descended from royalty, became an American president. Well, it's very true. People don't believe it because they quickly count up to 44, and he's not one of them, you know. But there's 14 before the 44, which people don't know. And these guys were great patriots, and they stuck their neck out for this country, especially Hancock. Through this process, I developed a lot of appreciation for an awful lot of our heroes and finding out things I didn't know about them before, you know, and also, unfortunately, finding out things on the other side that I didn't know either, which, makes you kind of wonder. But we seem to survive in this country despite ourselves. Sometimes I wonder how, but it's incredible.
<Exactly.
laughs> I thought I knew a little bit about history, but boy, this guy just—I have to admit—he kind of blew me away. And I have a Facebook page entitled Arthur St. Clair, the Invisible Patriot, where I keep that up. I add a new wrinkle every week, and they can look up the information on that. And of course, Right now, my best selling, other than what I sell myself, is on Amazon.com, and they have a big write-up on it, too, and they have excerpts from the book and things like that. They also have reviews there, too. So that's where other people can get another idea. And Barnes & Noble has the book in three states. They're doing a trial market with it, and that's about as far as I've gotten. I've only had a year to do this, so I'm only one guy. This is as far as I've gotten. But
well, congratulations on the book, Dick. It really is a great read.
You.
It's a great story to be told. It's one that needed to be told, in my opinion. And you've told it well, I think.
Thank you. Let me reciprocate, you know, your discovery of the DNA going back to Knights Templar time and all that was, I use that all the time. I mean, I didn't say it as well as you say it, but I'm always working that in somewhere because that just blows me away. I mean, I had it tracked back to 1500, but you really rang the gong on that one. That was really inspiring. It actually gives me inspiring because that's the family, generally speaking, that he came from, you know. And so we're, you know, we have a mutual admiration society going here. But thanks again.
Well, Dick, thank you. It's been a great show.
Are we out of time now, finally?
We're just about out.
Okay.
I want to thank our listeners for signing in again, and those who listen today, and those who you'll be able to listen to this in the future. It'll stay at the link where you found it. And please get the book, Arthur St. Clair, The Invisible Patriot, by R.W. Dick Phillips. As you said, it's Amazon and a few other places. And Dick, great work. Pleasure talking to you. Let's do it again
you
soon.
Too, as always, Steve. I appreciated the opportunity. Thanks.
Very much. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.